Somali people are really, it's an oral culture.
Yeah.
It's based in sound, it's based in orality, there's a musicality to the way we speak, the way we sing. And also, actually, it was mainly based on the fact that my mum can't read and write as well. Basically, there's a generation of women that were never taught to read and write. I've always thought about literacy in a kind of more expansive way. Like, I feel like it's exactly what you said about education, where you are being prepared for a world of work. There's a kind of idea that people who cannot read or write suddenly are not bright.
Yeah.
And actually, that's absolute, for me, that's so dumb.
Yeah.
Like, it's such a narrow way of thinking about intelligence
yeah.
and what makes a human being capable. And I think it's one of the reasons I started off working in food. It's a very accessible medium in which to do workshops with people.
Mm.
And so that's really what it was about. It was about cutting out anything that would require young people or older people or anything to have to do that kind of, you have to now write. You know, it's like, what can you do that allows you to think about the world and process things that without necessarily, and using your hands or your voice without it being so based on the written language.
Mm. And that's really interesting because, like, I guess because we both started out doing food work and I found a really similar thing with food. It's like, well, actually, what is the knowledge that lives in your body, in your hands, in your taste buds? Mm. And that is all knowledge that massively gets overlooked.
Yes.
And
because it's about the body.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, of course, yeah. Western rational scientific knowledge making doesn't
ignores
account
the body.
For it. Yeah.
Just as a, it's yeah. just the brain.
Yeah, yeah, it's just the brain. As though our brain and our body aren't the same thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and like I'm trying to reconcile this like embodied knowledge
yes.
with the way I do work. Because obviously I also work in a university in a very, very traditional knowledge system.
Yeah.
And so much of my work has been like trying to go, well, what about these other ways of knowing? I think we spoke about that in relation to weaving
yes.
with the Akal and with the tapestries
yes.
as well.
Yeah.
And I'd love to hear more about how you came to that
yeah.
Yeah, from absolutely. The food stuff.
Yeah.
And you and Ayan both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Both developed that. It kind of came out, the first project we did together was Camel Meat and Tapes, which was at the Arnold Feeney. Mm-hmm. And I got a city fellowship. They were doing these kind of things about trying to make the Arnold Feeney more accessible to people in the city.
Yeah.
And thinking about invisible histories of the city. And what I kind of proposed was, I've always had this thing about cassette tapes because of memories of, you know, these cassette tapes arriving with this mukamad, this nomadic meat product, that dried meat, which is like jerky. And so there was, in my head, I remember as a child, there would be gatherings and there'd be like this excitement when a tape would arrive from Somalia. And all the while there was a civil war going on, right? We arrived in 1985, which is early, but there would have been the genocide starting in that time. So there's all sorts of things that I think about our history that I'm unaware of, you know, that there was a mass genocide committed in the north where we're from, that the Somaliland resistance, a genocide that actually America was complicit in, like what's happening in Palestine.
Mm.
America's always at the heart of this stuff, and Britain. All of these countries were complicit in the Civil War because they were arming this leader in the South, you know. And prior to that, why was there a Civil War? Because of colonialism, because the British had occupied our northern area, the whole region of the East Africa, that whole horn, which is made up of a lot of Somali people, but also other people. You know, you got colonialism, and the way it divided up Africa was so damaging.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the impact it had long term, we're still living with it. So these tapes became this kind of amazing vessel for keeping in touch with relatives. And they were rare at the time. You know, it takes ages to get a tape back and forth, and especially from how you're getting tapes in and out of a country, which is going through all of this stuff. But what I found fascinating was the way in which the muqamat, the camel meat, became like a symbol, like it was the excitement for my mum and other like Somali people just being like, we have our meat, we have our nomadic meat. So it was like this food product is so special that they were also doing that, you know. So it wasn't just about hearing relatives, it was also getting a taste for the landscape that they left.
That's lovely.
You know, so I've always been fascinated by what are the aspects of our material culture that matter to us. It's like you leave a lot of things behind, but it's interesting what stays. Yeah. Like, so the taste of that nomadic camel meat. So that's why it was called Camel Meat and Tapes. So, and then from that sound, you know, project, it was a sound-based project, but there was an amazing woman called Fatima, and we worked with a range of elders, and they were so feminist, they were amazing. And in a way, we do model our practice on the way we saw our elders work together and the way that they taught us. So it was a real privilege, that project, I feel like, working with our elders and seeing what they value and the way that they center. Like, they don't really care about this system of knowledge production here. It's meaningless. Like, but the level of, like, it's like they're so centered. These women are so radical.
Yeah.
Like, they are so radical. They're so amazingly much braver than us. They don't buy into these institutional frameworks.
Yeah.
For me, I was like, wow, that's so amazing. And for Ayan too, I think, you know, it was just all of, you know, we were blown away, and we thought, how can we center Somali thinking and Somali women's thinking and Somali work in this way to help us heal, but also process and, you know, really, like Fatuma passing on a woven tapestry where she sang from it, like almost like it was a sheet of music, and then there's a weaving song in there. So weaving became a real theme about how women gather and make things for the home. We were like, oh, there's all these beautiful weaving songs, but the weaving songs are also about carrying that embodied knowledge, and that embodied knowledge is passed on through the hands, through the making, through weaving, and that has happened for thousands of years,
yeah.
You know, and now because of climate change and because of the civil war and because it is at risk, and that was heartbreaking. Got a research grant from the Watershed and the Pervasive Media Studio to kind of explore how can we incorporate this sound, these weaving songs, and bring to life that embodiedness in that material object that's been woven. How do we do that? And that's what led to this House of Weaving Songs project, really.
Mm.
So it's been years and years in the making, but it's really beautiful to center those people and those women as well.
So Sarah Ahmed, in Living a Feminist Life, she has this one line where she says that sometimes in different communities, it's like the way you learn feminism from within your community may not always look like feminism to outsiders,
yeah. Yeah.
But it's those are really, really important moments.
Yeah.
And I think about, you know, my mum setting up this women's group in Leicester, who I'm like connecting to through this project.
Yeah.
And like, it was just, you know, she's a beautician. She got to speak to women while they were on her couch or, you know, in her chair.
Yeah.
It's a really caring practice. And it was also so intimate that they'd tell her things that they wouldn't tell anybody else in the community.
Yeah.
And through this, she's just like found that there was this shared experience of like feeling, I mean, you know, we've spoken about patriarchal violence, and like, let's acknowledge it's not specific to immigrant communities. Patriarchal violence is everywhere.
Yeah.
And so she set up this women's group, and it was literally like, oh, it's just a women's group. Oh, you know, it's not important. It's just a women's group. And what she did was she created this safe space for women from the South Asian community to just come together and like have somewhere to go.
Yeah.
And like, I grew up with this, that's and I crazy. Never realized how important it was that she'd done that. And I don't think she realizes how important it is. And I think it's one of the reasons why I really want to revisit that and kind of have that conversation and kind of go, well, what was this? Because even while we were doing it, we didn't talk openly about it. We all knew what so-and-so auntie was dealing with at home and so-and-so was dealing with, you know, like their child and, you know, and I was friends with these kids. So, you know, I was hearing about it from a completely different perspective.
Yeah.
But we never once kind of went, oh, this is happening. We need to do something about it. Or call the police. Because you never would. Yeah, yeah. You never would. Yeah. Because outsiders coming in would never see the full story. They'd see, you know, this specific incident. The entire legal system, the justice system in the UK is incredibly racist. Yeah. And so you don't bring them in. You deal with it internally. And for better or for worse, that is what happened.
Yeah.
And this was one of the ways that this was dealt with. And you think about those moments, because I also go, you know, there's certain things where my mum and I just don't get along and we have frustrations because we are of different generations. We have very different experiences growing up. And we have different values. But like that was such a formative moment for me that I don't think I realised.
Yeah.
Because my mum was the first woman in our community to divorce her husband because of violence. And she was absolutely shunned by that community, except for when she was offering them this service in terms of like coming to get their waxing or their threading done. And then she went, no, you know, I'm going to create this space.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and it was so her creating her own community.
Yes, yes, and, absolutely.
And you go, wow, like, you know, these women know. Mm. It's kind of different in a way as well, because like when you were talking about like, you know, the literacy and how we use literacy as the framework for how we define intelligence, like, you have to remember things if you don't write them down.
Yes. Memory matters.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And the singing, I think, is a part of that. With the weaving, it's kind of a way of remembering how to do these patterns, how to, because it's all number based. This way of doing maths and patterns in your head and remembering it through rhythm, which I think's kind of brilliant.
Absolutely. And, you know, people talk about the relationship between maths and music, but that is such a powerful and obvious. Yeah. I can't remember where I was reading this, but it was in an exhibition. I've completely forgotten the name of the artist. But she'd put a loom in a project about technology because she was talking about how the loom was the first computer.
Yes. Yeah.
Actually, what you're doing is quite complex maths. And it's one of the reasons why, like, a lot of the first coders were women, because they were human computers.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and so there is this, like, link between weaving and maths and computing and technology.
Which is amazing, isn't it? I find that really fascinating. But that it, because it's women's work or because it's domestic, that it's not looked at as doing maths.
I think it's important to acknowledge, like, Hinduism is not having a great moment right now.
Yeah.
You know, you were dealing with like the election happening in India, the Hindu far right movement, Hindutva, like literally going out and lynching Muslim families in the street.
Yeah.
And they're using Hinduism as the pretext for that.
Yeah.
Hindus are not covering ourselves in glory, because my community right now is also, it's got massively Tory, because the Tories are being led by far right Hindus, let's face it.
Yeah.
Because Modi is
all right Hindu.
Exactly. Yeah. And like what's happening in Leicester right now, it's painful because there is so much tension between the Hindu and Muslim communities.
Yeah, how do we learn from these communities that are actually at the forefront of this food insecurity, that are at the forefront of having to deal with these issues, but also the recognizing the impact of the communities here who are having to deal with it, you know? So part of the reason we do the work we do in the way we do it is Somali people are affected here in multiple ways. So they're one of the poorest communities. On top of that, you know, any money they manage to gather and organize themselves, a lot of it goes back to support people who are suffering from drought or to support, you know, so remittances are a really key part. So then you've got this kind of double, this almost triple injustice of like, I don't know, of this climate collapse affecting immigrant communities and diaspora across the world who take jobs. They'll take the worst paying jobs. They are there. They're the backbone. You see this invisible workforce on top of having to deal with the racism and on top of having to deal with ignorance and then having to deal with knowing that the communities that they grew up in, or that culture that they grew up in, or that world is being completely decimated because of droughts. You know, and it's sort of mad. And there's no kind of, how do you hold space for that? A lot of the weaving practice is about that. It's a well-being practice, it's about gathering, it's about kind of using that old way of actually healing that Somali women did so well when they would build together and they would weave together. And it's almost spiritual because they would weave together and gather, but actually part of that gathering and weaving together is the incidental chats that happen and the therapy. It's exactly like what your mum set up, right? Mm-hmm. This is how feminism is done within certain communities.
Mm.
She set up that space to, or like when people do henna.
Yeah.
You know, hennas are not, you know, this lovely, caring, kind of intimate moments between women.
Yeah, and we did that at the retreat, and Farah and Tasneem were doing the henna, and I remember looking around at one point just going, this
that
is it.
That was a beautiful moment.
This is the moment.
Mm.
We are on Bristol Harbourside on the dock. Yeah. Quite close to where old Colston went into the water.
Yeah.
And I know he's not down there anymore.
Yeah.
But I feel like there is a resonance and an echo here, because I feel like this, to me, has always been the site of, like, colonialism in Bristol, right?
Yes.
Because this is the industrial project.
Yeah.
All of which was built using the labour and the resources and the money, crucially, that people made from things like colonialism and the slave trade. There's evidence to show that actually the areas that are the most deprived tend to have the dirtier waterways.
Yes.
Like, we all know this to be true. The Environment Agency says we can't prove it, but we suspect this to be true.
Yeah.
And if we look at what's happening with the waterways in the UK right now,
yeah,
you've got so much pollution, you've got literal, like, sewage overflow.
Yeah.
And obviously this happens more in areas where migrant communities are.
Yeah.
Because they tend to be the most deprived areas. So the area in Leicester where I want to do the next iteration of workshops, it's been experiencing record pollution the point that, like, the oxygen levels dropped so much last year that literally the fish were dying and floating to the top.
That's so awful.
Yeah, and that's right behind the Leicester College, where they were hoping to connect to some of the students to do some work around that. I think it's really, really important as well, because I think we've spoken about this a little bit, but, like, you know, there's that, when you migrate, there's that disruption, there's that, like, disconnection from land that happens. But because of racism, because of weather, because of, like, so many experiences that so many of our elders have had when they've been outside, they don't necessarily connect to the landscapes here.
Yeah. And so, but also, they're not particularly welcomed in to the landscapes.
Yeah.
So they have a different relationship to that. But it's quite interesting to see the disconnect as well of people, like the UK's approach to waterways, you know, and all of the sewage going into water, all of the lack of respect generally for anything, the environment, is pretty shocking.
Yeah.
You know, because there's such a disconnect that our bodies still need water, that we need to eat from the land, that we need to, you know, we haven't evolved that much. We're still animals that just rely on what the earth can provide. So if you pollute it to the point where your fish are, you know, and the wider impacts on wildlife. So it is interesting, I find, like, that kind of, there's just an ignorance, I think, about what we need and how we protect it. So remember with the beef, remember the cow disease? Yeah. And I remember my mum going, I can't believe these people are so stupid. You know, just the basics of, like, that would never happen in Somalia, because we understand that, you know, you can't feed an animal that doesn't eat meat. Like, you can't, you shouldn't, you know, feed it what it would normally have.
Yeah.
Not to, as a waste, you know, sheep's brains and other, like, it's just bizarre to think that you could just leap over things like that. I don't know. There's just a general disconnect between the body, the landscape, and this idea that you could just control it however you want, which then gets impacts on this stuff, like the waterways.
Yeah. Well, also, there's, like, the political history there as well, isn't it? Because, like, all of our water waste treatment is privatised in the UK.
Yes.
And it was privatised in the 80s under Thatcher. And there has been no new investment in the infrastructure since then. If you think about how much the population has grown, you're putting all of this pressure on this system that, like, in some cases, dates to Victorian times.
Yeah.
And people wonder why this is happening, and we're not holding the right people to account. This, there are people who are profiting from these waterways.
Absolutely.
And so, of course, they're going to keep that money. They're not going to invest it because they're not providing a public service to them that is a profit-making enterprise. In some ways, again, it's a microcosm, macrocosm of what you see happening in other parts of the world. Like, because all of these things, all of the land ownership, the waterway ownership, all of these things are things that were practiced through colonialism in other places and proved successful in these particular ways, and then were brought back here and enacted on people here.
Yeah.
Or they were tested out here and then they were taken to other places. Like land ownership. Like, what is that?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
it's such a
And I remember my mum going, like, what do you mean they own land? Who can own land?
Yeah.
And I was just like, Mum, I didn't know you were this radical. And she's not. But, you know, there's just some things where it's like, no, land is shared.
Yeah.
Everyone shares the resource that is land.
Absolutely. You don't just take it. Yeah. Well, it's owned because they take it through violence.
Yeah. There's a statistic that a lot of people in climate justice spaces cite, which is that 85% of the biodiversity in the world is safeguarded by indigenous people who make up less than 5% of the world population. Yeah. And I'm struck by what you said in terms of, like, because of course there is so much biodiversity in Somaliland.
Yeah.
And when we think about biodiversity, we think about places that, like, are, like, really lush, perhaps.
Yeah.
But of course
there's so much
all of that biodiversity. It's the diversity part that's important.
Yeah.
And then I was also thinking about, like, narratives around the Zionist project making the desert bloom in Palestine.
Yeah.
And how they kind of justify the... It's the terra nullius, right? It's the indigenous people were not using this land correctly. Yeah. We're going to
extract more of the land as well. It's not even that they're not using it correctly. They cannot fathom that indigenous people take care of the land.
Yeah. Or work with...
Or work, like, work with the land.
Yeah.
Like, they, it's not about extracting every last ounce of what this land can provide you, but understanding that there is a symbiotic relationship, you know? So how can you extract something to the point of destroying it and thinking that it has no consequence to you? Mm. It's just a completely different reference because there's no respect. There's no respect for the natural environment because... They believe technology will save us. They believe money will save us. They believe you can throw money at a problem.
Yeah.
The thing I've never understood about the culture here, they literally, it's like, you still need to eat, man. You still, like, literally, how are you going to eat money?
Yeah.
When you have a situation where agriculture fucking stops working, like, what do you, what are you going to do then?
That's really common. There's like a 3 or 4 step thing from climate denier to, we've got to do something about this shit. And the second one is, technology will save us.
Yes. Oh,
like,
my
we
God.
Can just build some more shit and that'll sort it out.
Oh my God. And where is the shit being built from?
Exactly.
This
and
component?
It's being built from the extracted things from from the earth.
Yeah.
So, like, I hate to tell you this, but, like, your like meal replacement shake is still coming from
someone
from the earth. And it, you know, and it's the whole cheap food thing as well, isn't it? You know, and we're creating this hierarchy where who gets to eat sustainably, who gets to eat organic, who gets to buy things that are sustainable, and
it's really depressing.
And because the cost lives somewhere, and like, you know, if you can buy sustainable lobster in your local supermarket and it's affordable, it's probably because somebody somewhere was massively exploited
to do that.
And it's the thing I was saying yesterday about, like, we're all complicit.
Oh,
we're
God,
all
continuously
complicit. But some people are definitely living the impacts in a much more immediate way. And I think this is the thing for those of us who have migrated. Most of us have family in areas that are seeing the impact of climate change, like, so immediately. Like,
I mean,
in
India
is
boiling at the minute, isn't it? I mean, the heat waves that happen in India.
People are dying.
It's,
And you go, wow, okay, so... You know, yes, we're starting to feel the impacts of it here, and it's accelerating. And, you know, we've only got a certain number of harvests left in the soil here. Yeah. But who are the people who are going to go first? Yeah. Who are the people who are going to suffer?
Yeah.
And then you create these kind of horrific, draconian laws to stop migration when you are literally destroying the ecosystems in those places to the point where people can't live there.
Yes, yeah.
And
that's where, like, this border violence comes in. I'm trying to be hopeful, I really am, but I think the plan is let these people die. I truly believe that, because I don't think there's enough urgency, and also the justification for letting mass groups die in the global south is the kind of, you kind of start increasing the racism, right, and white supremacy. And because if you look at what's happening with white supremacy, it's scary. They don't. They should be seen as a terror group. Yeah. Like, these kind of eco-fascists. They're not even just eco-fascists. They're just blaming everything on foreign people and foreign labour.
Yeah.
And not understanding that this is not the problem. The problem is the 1% of private jet, the super rich who are extracting more and more and more from you.
Yeah. Like, literally, no one needs that much money, and they have more money than anybody needs.
It's disgusting.
Yeah.
It's absolutely disgusting.
And it's like, you know, those people that go, oh, just earn more money and give more to charity. It's like, by earning more money, you are literally destroying the planet.
Yeah.
Like, that is how that works. It's unfortunate, but it is a zero-sum game.
Yeah.
Your profit relies on extraction of the earth. This is not something we can put back.
Yes, yeah.
And there are people who are suffering as a result of it.
Yeah.
So I guess my thoughts to be added. For me, growing up, I always felt disconnected from the land. And as a family, I guess, overall as well, newly arrived to the country with very little connections. We relied on small organisations that did good work. And I remember them being based in St. Paul's. I can't remember the name of the organisation. I would love to. They were amazing. These organisations, they ran programmes that would take us, but also other families who were, I guess, on the poverty line, but also didn't really have any resources, but were kind of stuck in the city. They would take us out the city and into the countryside. And I remember they would take us out, but also like little trivial things. They would take us out to like Swindon, and we would go to the Swindon Swimming Centre. Sometimes we'd go out and we'd go to like a kind of adventure playground that was on the outskirts or somewhere in the southwest. I never really knew where it was. I was quite young when I went to these places. But I know that these trips were often little and few between, but I remember that they had a kind of transformative effect on me and on my summers, because, you know, I had friends who were going off elsewhere and going camping and doing all these things. But for me, it was like a big kind of deal to be able to be taken away on a bus, but it was like a day trip. It was never overnight. It was never foraging. It was never these kind of experiences. And because of the social issues in the area, my parents' paranoia, I wasn't really allowed out much. So I treasured these moments so much. I was always chaperoned as well if I went to the park or went any further. But
that has a lot to do with the fact that we were living in a particular area and it wasn't considered norm or normal to go beyond, because it was, as a young woman, it was like, well, we don't know what will happen to you. We don't feel like you're safe. And as a family, we'd always watch almost, I can't remember if it was on a weekly basis, I don't know how long, but Crime Watch was a big thing in our family. So I don't know if that like built up our anxiety as a family unit as a whole, but also a lot was going on. And I think also the information generally for my family and also just other families who are newly arrived in the city, there's nothing to say, oh, there's a harbour here. You know, I can't believe that it took me until I was 30 to ever know that there was a harbour or a bit of peace and quiet, that I could walk around the harbour or there was somewhere that I could go and there was a body of water. I had no idea. And then since then, I've discovered like that bit of water stretches out across so much of Bristol and it's beautiful. You know, you can cycle, you can get a bus to some degree, but, and then I've kind of gone beyond that more as an adult and it feels like a almost bonkers to think that it's taken this many years of my life to get to a point that I can go that far, but also in a way that's probably maybe why I have never left this city, because like day by day I am exploring so much more than I had ever had access to as a young person. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that there isn't a kind of a good integration system for refugees or newly arrived people into England or, you know, Britain. There's nothing there to really help people understand that actually there are so many beautiful parts of this country. It's a shame because a lot of Bristolians, particularly if people of colour, are isolated or locked out because of a lack of knowledge. I do think the plan is to accept the death of the global south, mostly because of this racist and white supremacist idea of overpopulation. They have been telling us for some time that our lives are disposable. And I just, to a degree, think that in some sense, there's no fighting that, not that there's no fighting that, I don't think that's defeatist, but more so that there is an element where they don't want us to fight these things. They want us to think that there's nothing more. Like, that is it. And actually, we close the borders, we accept that there is nothing more. And actually, there's nothing, a thing that kind of validates that is the fact that there are people who are basically being forced out of their homes due to climate change in Scotland, per se, and nothing's being done about that, or at least to our knowledge, and it's not being documented in the media. We don't know that that's all going on, but people, you know, there are coastal towns that are being decimated by climate change, and that's something that we not only need to consider, but also think about, why is it that we're not hearing that information? And I think a lot of that has to do with the brace, but there you go.
Sometimes I think there's a lack of respect for that nomadic history and tradition. Mm. Maybe people feel embarrassed because it feels like it's poor people. And actually, you know, statistically, yeah, we probably are like some of the poorest people in the world. Not me, my, you know, the people out there are probably some of the poorest people in the world. But also the impact of things like lack of infrastructure around hospitals, and that's horrible, you know. But everything else around the culture that is really sustaining and really intuitive and smart about how you live is actually really beautiful and worth holding on to. Yeah. So I'm like, you don't have to develop in development, when they even use that word, I hate it, it's kind of looks at it in such a linear way. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, actually, there's a lot we can learn from how they live. But it's hard if it goes.
Yeah.
You can't really learn from it. And so what are the things you want to preserve from that, and then how can you pass it on?
Mm.
It's a real challenge. And then also talking about climate. So all of this does allow us to talk about climate. Like the grasses, like, nah, you don't make that. But look, you make off old socks and old clothes. I love the way that's a really lovely woven thing my aunt and I have made. Isn't it beautiful? But it was made from whatever fabrics that were left over. So it's like this idea that you make from whatever's around you.
Mm.
So things aren't wasted.
Yeah.
You know, you shouldn't really buy it. Like my aunt would have wool. We send her wool sometimes, or she would buy it from wherever and we send her the money for it. But it's like, that's a treat, like working with those colours. So I like working in bright colours, because when my aunt goes wild, it's like she goes really abstract with it, and I really like that, and I feel like that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Like just the natural artisticness coming out of these women.
It's like the kitchen again, isn't it? It's like, yeah, finding spaces to be creative and, yes, to have agency.
Yes. Yeah.
And to express that creativity.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really important.